Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. First, we're going to go back in time to listen to recently discovered recordings of extemporaneous speeches made at a rally on the OSU campus the day after Dr. King was assassinated. Joining us is Hassan Kwame Jeffries. He's an associate professor in the history department at OSU. Professor Jeffries also holds a joint appointment at the Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity. He is the author of Bloody Lounge, Civil Rights and Black Power in Alabama's Black Belt. Welcome back, Hassan.
Thank you very much. Great to be here.
Also joining us is James Upton. He's Associate Professor Emeritus in the Department of African American and African Studies at OSU. Professor Upton was the recipient of a Rockefeller Foundation Research Fellowship and was awarded the OSU Alumni Award for Distinguished Teaching in 2005. Welcome to the show, Jim.
Thank you very much.
For our listeners, where were you the day after the assassination of Dr. King? Did you participate in any memorial or other events associated with the tragedy? Give us a call. Tell us about your memories of that, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page, and you can tweet at @AnnFisherWOSU. The audio recordings we're going to hear today were made by WOSU in 1968 and recently discovered by the Ohio State University Archives. They are, for the most part, brief and extemporaneous speeches by black and white students. Most of them are unidentified. It's at a black student union rally on the Oval on April 5th, 1968, the day after Martin Luther King was assassinated. These are raw recordings, not an interview, so the speakers won't be identified by name. Let's listen to this statement by a young black man.
I respect the man a great deal. I differ with him on many points. I agree more with what Stokely says. But in relation to King, you're here because of him, and his death relate to it as he would like you to relate to it. He would hope that his death would bring some kind of cohesiveness within the country. A mental kind of cohesiveness.
He talked about cohesiveness within the country. Was this a typical reaction, especially among younger members of the black community, or was it an isolated one? Hassan?
You know, there was a range of reactions. There was a range of emotions brought about by the news of King's assassination. And we'll listen to some more of those clips, and I think we'll hear a little bit more of that range. But for many, and Dr. Upton certainly can speak to this as well, for many, you know, people realized and recognized what King's driving mission was. And that was not just to create a better world in sort of a broad, undefined sense, but to bring people together, to bring the African-American community together, black people together, black unity together, create black unity, but then also to bring the broader American community together. So in that sense, this idea of cohesiveness, let's move as one, let's work together to build a better society, is something that was understood by many in the African-American community, although the path to obtaining it would be a source of great disagreement going forward, and even at that moment.
When the speaker refers to Stokely Carmichael, he's comparing his path to King's. Can you talk a little bit about how they differed?
Certainly. You know, Stokely Carmichael, who by 1968 had embraced the name Kwame Ture, worked hand in hand quite closely with Dr. Martin Luther King. Stokely Carmichael, 1966, becomes the chairman of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee, and he ushers in the slogan, Black Power. So at the time of King's death, 1968, the call was no longer Freedom Now, but Black Power. And this idea of Stokely's path, essentially what Carmichael was advocating, was this idea of black political empowerment, first and foremost, saying, and this would evolve and change over time, saying that the best way to change society is not necessarily to change hearts and minds. It doesn't matter where the opposition or how the opposition feels about you. What's important or what matters most, the path to change, is to gain power. gain political power. And for Carmichael, that was at the heart of the Black Power slogan. And so when this young brother is talking about, you know, I follow Carmichael's path, he was saying in a very brash terms and tones, it's time to stop asking or begging for a change in society, as Carmichael would phrase it, and start demanding, seizing, and taking that change.
That movement was already underway, as you pointed out, but was it at all radicalized even further by the assassination of Dr. King?
You know, I think that Dr. Jeffers is quite correct. The Black Power movement was an extension of the civil disobedience movement. It was probably a next historical step. But King was pretty consistent right down the line. I mean, he had a lot, there was contention with King, with Kwame Ture at this time. And in King's letter to the Birmingham City Jail, I mean, he made the statement that to those, you know, who said, you know, that you were moving too fast, you know, his whole point was if it had not been for the civil disobedient movement, that the streets of the South would be flowing with blood. And he also just echoed, you know, the whole notion that if it had not been for that, and we had advocated a path of Black Power, that would have created a racial nightmare. Now, his concern, his worry, was that whether or not American society valued nonviolence, and he wasn't sure if that was the case. He talked about, you know, in his book that that violence, you know, in America is the worst, most brutal, and the most uncivilized value of American life. And that had to be stopped. And, you know, King, you know, had contention with those who were advocates of Black Power right along the line. Many of his lieutenants and many of his supporters abandoned him. But he was consistent. And one of the things that he said all along was, if I'm the only person in America that advocates nonviolence, he said, I'm going to stay with it. That's important for the redemption of America.
Let's hear another clip by another young African-American man that day.
You know, they have killed a brother who preached peace. And we ought to understand that we can no longer deal with the man over the bargaining table or any mechanism like that. The only thing he understands is violence. The only thing that he understands is violence. And that's all we wanted to say.
You know, clip made me turn to a statement that Columbus Mayor Emmy Sensenbrenner said, the statement that he handed out that day and was published in the Dispatch and elsewhere. He said, we should be able to sit down at a round table and discuss these things. And it sounded naive that when you contrast that with what that young man was saying at the rally, really? At that point, after all the lynchings, after all the murders and all of the tragedy and the death and the McGravins and the Robert F. Kennedy, all after FRX at Kennedy, I should say, after all of that, what did you think about that kind of a comment at that point? And there were a lot of them. It was echoed by many, many public officials, that same sort of, gee, this is horrible. I can't believe this happened.
Right. You know, It does reflect a certain naivete at the time, but it also speaks to the reason for the deep frustration on the part of many African Americans who understood that they were living in a white supremacist society that was undergirded by violence. Whether you were in Columbus, Ohio, dealing with the police, or you were in Mississippi dealing with the Citizens Council, or Alabama dealing with the Klan, or anywhere in the South dealing with ordinary white folk, you were dealing with violence. And so African Americans for the longest time, even before emancipation, had been trying to sit at the bargaining table to get change. And it required going to the streets in the form of mass nonviolent protest, civil disobedience, to get people to the table. And so I think what this brother is saying is, you know, we tried it even that way to get to the bargaining table. And then perhaps the only way that we're going to get to the bargaining table, get people to sit down and talk with us and negotiate, is if is through other means. Again, speaking to that frustration with the pace of progress, but also with the unwillingness of those in power to really negotiate fairly, to listen to the demands of African Americans, and to listen and take seriously the problems and issues that, and concerns that they were raising.
My guests are OSU History Professor Hassan Kwame Jeffries and also OSU African American African Studies Professor Emeritus James Upton. Of course, you're welcome to join the conversation, 614-292-8513. If you have a question or a comment, do you remember those times? Give us a call and tell us what you thought about them then and how it changed you, perhaps. You can also email us at allsides@wosu.org. Many civil rights leaders called for a nonviolent response to the assassination to honor his life's work. But there was that was there an age difference or an age gap between folks that were calling for that and younger folks that were saying, no, this is it. They've drawn the line in the sand.
You know, I think there probably was an age gap, and I think a necessary age gap. I think in retrospect, you know, King, you know, understood, although he may not have articulated this, that both methods, you know, needed to be in place. All he was saying was, I'm not going to abandon, you know, what I'm doing. That, you know, and, you know, you notice in his I Have a Dream speech, one of the statements that he made there was he tried to validate the people, you know, who had been abused and who had been scorned. And he says, for some of you, and maybe this is a division of labor, and maybe this is just my own analysis of this, but there's a division of labor of those of you who have been abused and scorned. You know, there's a reason for doing so, because America had to be redeemed. And that was your mission. Your mission was to redeem those who had scorned and those who had abused you. And, of course, you know, the blind can't lead the blind. And by accepting that abuse, you would redeem your enemy. And he saw that as a mission, not for everyone, but a mission for some in this society, because we can't continue to go down a path where violence begets violence. And it's like the blind leading the blind. And someone had to play that role. Now, that number began to diminish as time moved on, and particularly after we turned 1966 in this particular regard. But one of the things, as the numbers who supported nonviolence began to diminish, in his book, Where Do We Go From Here at KRSI Community, he was standing there and said, the numbers are small, but when I look around, I see Jews and Gentiles. I see Protestant and Christian. I see whites and blacks. I see blue collar and white collar. And in that moment, he just says that I see a glimpse of God, of what this nation can become. And that was the hope that continued to inspire him. And without a vision and without hope, there's no future. And so as discouraged as he was still hopeful. This had to take place, and some people had to play the role of those who would turn the other cheek, because by turning the other cheek, you redeemed your enemy, and you forgave your enemy, and someone had to play that role, and that was a role of people he was calling upon.
And apparently that role of peace that he played brought about his own death. That was so tremendously challenging to the people who opposed him. We're talking about the assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King in the context of the fact that coming up this Sunday, the 48th anniversary of the March on Washington and the I Have a Dream speech, President Barack Obama will dedicate the Martin Luther King Jr. Memorial on the National Mall. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
You can help shorten the 89.7 NPR News Winter Membership Drive. Become a sustaining member right now. For every 100 sustaining members we receive, we will eliminate one day from our drive. As a sustaining member, your membership never expires, and your member card renews annually. But right now, you can help take one day off of our upcoming drive. And the drive begins very soon, so visit WOSU.org and make your sustaining gift today.
Support for 89.7 comes from Columbus School for Girls. Information about curriculum in an all-girl environment is available at their admission open house, offering time to meet faculty and students Sunday, January 22nd at 1 p.m. More at columbusschoolforgirls.org.
Many 89.7 NPR News members have discovered the advantages of using the WOSU member card for two-for-one dining, cultural events, and family activities. Now there are additional benefits with the member card Benefit of the Month. The Benefit of the Month for January is Pro Musica Chamber Orchestra. Enjoy two-for-one admission to Happy Year of the Dragon, January 21st and 22nd. Become a basic $60 member and get your member card by going to WOSU.org now.
We've been listening to recently discovered WOSU recordings of a rally at OSU the day after his assassination. The rally was sponsored by the Black Student Union at OSU. Joining us is Hassan Kwame Jeffries. He's an associate professor in the history department at OSU. He also holds a joint appointment at the Corwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity. Once again, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
And also with us is James Upton. He's Associate Professor Emeritus in the Department of African American and African Studies at OSU. Once again, Professor Upton, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thanks again for you for joining us. We're going to listen right now to this young man. He turns the conversation to the whites in the audience and throughout the country.
I'm nonviolent, but I go along with some of the material that Stokely has been saying. That the whites haven't, that the whites are too willing to go down the Mississippi. They're too willing to go down to Alabama. But they're not willing to go back in their own neighborhoods where the racism exists and where they have the most influence. It's up to whites to talk to whites, to move them, or nonviolence is over.
I thought it was an interesting point that it's easy to go far from home and make a stand and take a stand on something like this, but to do it in your own backyard, literally, this fellow is suggesting, and I'm assuming he's white, is much more difficult.
No, that's certainly true, and I don't think he means to disparage the sacrifice and what it did take for the handful, and it wasn't that many. It was a small handful of whites who go down and participate on the front lines of the civil rights struggle during Freedom Summer, for example, a couple hundred, and it certainly doesn't mean to take anything away from them. But I think his point is an accurate one. The problem of racism in America has never been a problem in the black mind, but a problem in the white mind, a problem that affects both communities, both white and black, but a problem that whites have to wrestle with as well. Too often, even when we talk about the problems stemming from racism and inequality, we speak about it only in terms of those who are affected materially, affected directly. But we don't think about the long reach, the long arm of inequality and racism and how it affects not just African-Americans or people of color, but all people. I mean, King spoke eloquently about that, about how our fates are interwoven. They're linked together. And I think that's what this gentleman is saying. We need a social movement that reaches not just down into Mississippi, because the problem of racism and white supremacy wasn't just a regional problem, wasn't just a southern problem. It was an American problem that reached into the rural communities, but also into the suburbs of Ohio and Michigan and New York and California.
You know, Bob Marley brought up the issue in his song, "If You Have a Racist Friend, Now Is the Time for Your Friendship to End." In other words, it's not good enough just to not be racist yourself or to be working toward that end. It has to do with the people you associate with as well. You know, and they're talking about acts there and taking action. There's something about the action of nonviolence that I think maybe, you know, we should talk about. We were talking about it during the break. It wasn't just a passivity. It was an action, right? It was a form of action.
Yes, and I think that's the point that King was trying to make. It was an activist form of participation. But again, getting back to the point that King, I think, underscored his philosophy all along, is that there has to be another side. There was a disequilibrium in the society. Someone had to take the role of redeeming the other side, that America was born as a violent society, was maintained as a violent society, and condoned as a violent society. And that was the most uncivilized aspect of American society. And it had to be changed. And so he called upon, you know, those participants in this movement that this is your calling. In many ways, it's sort of the place they found themselves in history. You can also say it was maybe like a spiritual superiority, you know, because of the state and the place that they found themselves. But they must take that calling. They must, and the spirit of King is, you must turn the other cheek. Someone has to turn the other cheek. This is not an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. This was the New Testament for King. And if no one did that, because we're all interrelated together, and if we can continue to do that, we can reach this sort of common ground of a common humanity with a common destiny. And that's a difficult challenge, I think, for anyone.
And there's a distinction, though, between turning the other cheek and not coming forward and having them, you know, put the fire hoses on you and setting the dogs on you and the clubs.
Yeah, you know, I think you use the right word, and Dr. Upton certainly underscored it, and that is this notion of action. Civil disobedience and nonviolence as a practice was action. It was taking the battle from a moral perspective, certainly taking the moral high ground, but also engaging in action, taking it to the opposition. But I must also add, with regard to that, that when we look at King's life, he certainly was a person who was not born nonviolent necessarily. Mm-hmm. He was born mm-hmm. in America, was slow to embrace nonviolence. We mm-hmm. go back to the Montgomery bus boycott. He certainly early on, you know, petitions for files for a gun permit that the city of Montgomery turned down. But he was slow to embrace it. And that's important. But he did finally, of course, and embraced it as a philosophy, as a way of life. But that's an important point. Because, you know, he grew up in a violent society, but he also grew up as an African-American in a community in the South that embraced these very notions of a right to defend oneself. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, part of the discussion ought to be what led King to these positions and what did it take to cling to nonviolence philosophically as a way of life, not just as a practice, but as a guiding moral principle over time.
My guests are OSU History Professor Hassan Kwame Jeffries, also OSU African American and African Studies Professor Emeritus James Upton. We welcome your questions or comments, 614-292-8513. Coming up, we're going to talk more about that memorial. Do you plan on visiting the memorial, and what does it mean to you? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have a comment from Hal. He says, I was in Indiana and recall that Robert Kennedy announced the death of Martin Luther King to a campaign crowd in Indianapolis, only to be shot to death a couple of months later. What a spring it was. Professor Upton, you know, we were talking about that earlier. This didn't happen in a vacuum.
No, it didn't happen in a vacuum, and it affected, you know, all of us. I think the assassination of King was the personification of the violence that the excluded and African Americans in particular, you know, had experienced for so long. But what I would like to add is that I think as Professor Jeffries, you know, underscored, is that King was evolving in many ways. And I think the story hasn't been told enough that King at one point, you know, carried a gun. And this was for, you know, self-defense. He had the right to self-defense. That's a part of our U.S. Constitution. But you know, my greatest fear is that King is for us to make King too small of representing only one race of people, particularly after his Nobel Peace Prize that he received in 1964. You know, King saw himself as a leader of a rainbow coalition, and he involved himself, which probably was a part of a death warrant to him, to his anti-Vietnam War stance. He talked about the contradictions of dropping bombs in Hanoi while at the same time bombs have been dropped in Detroit and bombs have been dropped in Los Angeles. That was a concern to him. He was criticized for this, severely criticized for this. Just limit this whole thing to the plight for civil rights for people of color. King transcended that side. We never know exactly where King was going on this, but he was definitely in transition. When he engaged in the garbage strike in Memphis, you know, he was criticized, you know, stay out of that employment issue. But what King was involved in was not only for higher wages, but for their dignity. We remember during his time that those garbage workers, you know, had to eat their lunch in the back of a garbage truck. And that was a form of indignity for him. So their dignity was of a high priority. So he did transcend this. And I think it would be a mistake for us to limit King in some way or another. He became an international leader for the rights of the oppressed and for the rights of those who are excluded from society.
James in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Is that me?
That's you, James. Welcome to the show.
Thanks. My question is how your guests think the civil rights movement might have evolved differently had, I know this show is primarily about Dr. King, but if Malcolm X had not been assassinated earlier, how your guests think that might have affected the evolution of the civil rights movement, and I'll take the discussion off the air.
Thank you, James.
Well, I think we certainly know that at the time of Malcolm X's assassination, he had broken from the Nation of Islam, embraced a more traditional form of Islam, and along with that, was moving into a phase of activism that brought him closer to King. Not in terms of nonviolence, but in terms of what we had mentioned earlier, this idea of action. One of the reasons why he left the Nation of Islam and split with Elijah Muhammad is because of the limits that were placed on him in terms of what he could do in terms of organizing publicly, engaging in political protest, engaging in civil disobedience if he wanted to. And so once he split, once he left, he was free to engage in that type of activism. So in interesting ways, he was moving closer to King. But we also know that Malcolm X, just like King, as Dr. Upton just pointed out, embraced a broad understanding of what this struggle was about. It wasn't just about voting rights. It wasn't just about the desegregation of lunch counters or public accommodations. This was also about human rights. It was about economic rights. It was about the rights of laborers, the rights of people internationally. It was a global struggle. And at the time of Malcolm X's assassination, he was calling for a UN intervention, just as – so he was moving global, just as King was moving global at the time of his death.
614-292-8513, or we can you can get your questions or comments in via email at allsides@wosu.org. You can also go to the All Sides with Ann Fisher Facebook page. We're talking about the assassination of Martin Luther King. We've been listening to some tapes that were recently discovered. They were WOSU recordings that were recently discovered at the OSU archives. And they were from a rally that occurred the day after Martin Luther King was assassinated in 1968. In this next excerpt from the recording, a mother expresses her frustration with the future. Let's listen.
This is like the end. I got three kids at home. And I don't intend for him to grow up in this. I don't intend for him to. And if I can do anything, you know, like it's gotten down to the place now, you know, like the brother says, you know, arm yourself and get ready, baby.
Just a note to our listeners, the recordings have been edited for content. So if you see some gaps in there, it's true. We've taken some words out. Wish we didn't have to because Professor Jeffries, the words say something too. There's nothing really wrong with the words in the context of the message.
No, certainly not. It speaks not only to the rhetoric of the time, but also to the passion, the pain, the anguish, the anger that was felt at the moment. Here, this young sister, young mother is talking about, I don't want my children to grow up in this stuff, and stuff being the polite term for what you use that our listeners didn't hear. Mm-hmm. And that she, with her back up against the wall as she saw it, and we have to think about this as well. Dr. Upton well knows, and he's certainly the authority on sort of riots and as political action, if you will. Mm-hmm. You know, African Americans at this moment in time, when the symbol of nonviolent direct action, the person who believed in nonviolence deeply is slain, at the moment for many people, this was not only a last straw, but there was this idea of what on earth is there left? What will this nation listen to? If they can go after a man of peace, then they certainly can go after my three children on any street corner in America. And so for many, there was no option, or they saw no option other than to prepare themselves for a violent confrontation with the society that was already being violent towards them.
I think her phrase, "this is the end," was, it's wrenching, it's heart-wrenching.
Well, without hope and without a vision, you can't have a society. And for anything else, maybe we need another dream. But Keane was providing hope because he talked about this sort of interdependency of not only of all people within the United States, and he stated in his writing is that you can never be what you can be until I can be what I can be. But in the whole spirit of interdependency is that, you know, you get up in the morning and you have a cup of coffee or whatever the case may be, or a bowl of cereal, you know, you're already are participating in a global market. So he asked this sort of his rhetorical question, you know, how can that be? How can we have a world, because he now has transcended the United States, a world in which some, you know, have affluence and some have nothing? Because how can you be what you can be unless we can be unless all of us can be what we can be? And so he was trying to bring these two kind of polar ends, you know, to the center. And that was the core of his message. Now, I think on another point, too, as Professor Jeffries pointed out, King is complex. At one level, after he went to his speech about Detroit and his about the Detroit riots, the Los Angeles riots, you know, while he didn't condone it, he understood what that was, that these events were the voices of the unheard, and they have a voice. And that, you know, and they're not going to be silent, you know, forever. And we have to prevent this from happening. But this is understandable. This is understandable, and they can't wait forever. You know, the time is now, and this is an opportunity that America has to take. And this is what has been presented to the American people.
The mother, she sounds, I guess, for lack of a better word, radicalized at that point. And yet, in Columbus, at least, it was one of the larger cities. I grew up in Grand Rapids, Michigan, not smaller than Columbus or about the same size at the time, perhaps. There were riots in Grand Rapids, and of course there were riots in Detroit, but not Columbus.
It's sort of interesting about Columbus, and I think Columbus is an anomaly in many ways. I study riots as legitimate forms of social movement when all legal channels and legitimate channels have been closed to those who have been marginalized. Columbus is still under study. I think it has a lot to do just with the whole demographics of the city, the type of industry, the kind of work that people are in, service kinds of industry. And there's many migrants, you know, to this city from all over the South. And I think that it's an anomaly. I think we should celebrate it in its own way.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guests are OSU history professor Hassan Kwame Jeffries and also OSU African American and African Studies professor emeritus James Upton. Coming up, some more cuts from those recordings from 1968, and we'll talk about our newest memorial and the National Mall. So stay with us. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Fresh Air, you'll hear conversations with legendary personalities like comedian Joan Rivers.
My first joke was my husband killed himself and left a message that I have to visit him every day, so I had him cremated and sprinkled him in Neiman Marcus. Now, haven't missed a day.
Icons of the entertainment world on Fresh Air.
Weekdays at noon on 89.7 NPR News.
I'm Tom Ashbrook, host of NPR's On Point. Behind the news, there are real people with something to say. We bring them to you. Roundtable conversations with coal miners, the out-of-work soldiers, their families, and more. Honest conversations about the issues with the people who live their reality. It's fresh perspective you won't hear anywhere else. Join us for the next On Point.
Weekday afternoons at 1 on 89.7 NPR News.
Support for 89.7 comes from the estate of Donald R. Glancy, whose life was enriched by public radio and television, and whose bequest seeks to encourage others to discover WOSU Public Media.
It's a story 200 years in the making, brought to life by Ballet Met, the CJO, and WOSU. Jazz Moves Columbus celebrates the city's history in vibrant songs, thrilling dances, and stirring images. Experience the energy inspired by the city founded along two wild rivers. Jazz Moves Columbus, the story of our city through kicks, turns, and trumpet blasts. February 2nd through the 12th. For tickets, call 614-469-0939 or visit balletmet.org.
We've been listening to recently discovered WOSU recordings of a rally at OSU the day after his assassination. The rally was sponsored by the Black Student Union at OSU. Joining us is Hassan Kwame Jeffries, an associate professor in the history department at OSU. Also with us is James Upton. He's associate professor emeritus in the Department of African American and African Studies at OSU. Questions or comments, you know they're welcome. 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Beth from Clintonville, you're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I was just going to ask your guest members if Jimmy Carter, about a year or two into Obama's presidency, just said out, you know, just said straight out that he felt that the reason why the right was going after him so hard was because our country is still racist, and that this is a way to mask racism. And I do listen to Tavis Smiley and his show, and it is still about class. It's mostly about class now, but it still is about race. And I wanted to hear what your guest thought about that, what Carter said. And I know it's off topic, but it's still pertinent even today.
Thank you, Beth.
Oh, yeah, thank you, Beth. And I don't think it's off topic at all. I mean, one of the things that King gave his life for was to create a better society, a society in which white supremacy and racism didn't have such a negative impact on all members of society. Jimmy Carter's comments, and I remember a year or so ago when he made them, were bold, were profound, and were accurate. I think I don't think many people who study this and look at sort of American society will disagree that America is still profoundly racist. But what does that mean? People's attitudes have changed. We have different personal relationships that simply would not have existed 10 and 15, 20, certainly 30 years ago that span the races, that bridge races. But personal relationships don't stand in as a substitute for the ways in which race plays out in creating and undergirding and supporting racial inequality. And so too often when we have this conversations that revolve around race, and you hear people say, well, you know, I have these personal relationships. We're often not talking about personal relationships. We have to get to the heart of the matter, and the heart of the matter is dealing with these the ways in which racism is perpetuated, inequality is perpetuated in society through institutions and structures and politics. And I think once we do that, we begin to see that we still, although we've come a long way, we still have a long way to go.
Thanks again, Beth, for that call. I wanted to jump to another cut that kind of gets to the institutionalization of it and how things did seem to change around the late 60s, at least on the surface. Let's hear from this fellow we did know. He identified himself in the recording. His name's John Evans. He was head of the Black Student Union on campus at the time, and let's hear what he had to say.
We know about genocide here in America. We know that Black people are being killed in Vietnam. We know that we cannot vote. We cannot have a right to participation. Even when we ask the university for certain demands which have been neglected for 98 years, they have been denied systematically. We are tired of this. But we still go on a diplomatic basis to the people. And they let us down at all times. And the Black people are getting tired of this.
Let's talk about that time and what changed after that at the universities at like Ohio State. There was the Black Student Union, but there were no Black Studies at Ohio State or pretty much anywhere in the country at the time.
Yes.
Professor Upton?
And I think that we have to, I think, celebrate and I think recognize those brave students, the 34, you know, who were arrested. Many, John Evans and others who played that role. That was a very bold kind of a position that they had to take, and they made life a lot easier for a lot of us. I didn't arrive at Ohio State until 1970, and of course we know that there was a national housing law that passed in 1968, but you can even rent apartments in the university area in 1970, you know, when I arrived. And so one of the things that the students did at the time was that they had to go to the Office of Student Affairs and take down the names of available apartments that were for rent that excluded African-American people. So this was a beginning of a process, and these students had a vision, and we saw the realization of that vision with the establishment of the Department of African-American or Black Studies at the time, and subsequently the increase of African-American faculty members, you know, on the campus. So it was quite significant. John Evans was a very significant and a very prominent leader in that whole process.
Now I would just add that one of the important legacies of Black Power activism of the Black Power era was the establishment of Black Studies departments across the country. Too often Black Power is disparaged as simply rhetoric for the sake of rhetoric, but it achieved those who came up under its rubric, if you will, worked and demanded various things, and one of them becomes these Black Studies departments, whether it's here at Ohio State, one of the oldest, or at Cornell, or at Columbia, where even before King's assassination, students, Black students working with in partnership with community activists in Harlem were organizing and bringing demands on the administration to change the culture on the campus.
Mary in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show. You might have been at that rally in 1968.
Hi, is it me?
Yes, it is you, Mary. Welcome to the show.
Well, thanks. I was a freshman at OSU at that time, and I was real active in the peace movement. But my parents had been, because my father was a minister, were civil rights activists. And so I attended that rally that you're talking about, and then right after the rally, I think there was a march, and I was mm-hmm. in that march. I had, at the time, one of my roommates was Black, and through her, I was able to borrow a copy of the autobiography of Malcolm X from one of the other Black students that she was friends with. And so right after all of this happened, I joined VISTA, and to my parents' chagrin, left for Chicago, where I ultimately became friends with a Black student there and actually went to the Black Panther headquarters once, and then found out that the FBI was watching everything, and they came to my project leader and threatened to, fire me or whatever, because I was hanging out with people who hung out with the Black Panthers. Well, obviously, at age 19, I became very radicalized by all of these experiences, and I really wonder when or how we're going to get past the racism that is actually a divisive tool in what is really an economic and class issue. I mean, I totally get the horrors of racism, and I'm sure that most Black people are basically suffering from PTSD, especially young Black men in this society now. And I just kind of don't see a way around it. I mean, I think there's been some progress, but it's so slow, and it's not inclusive enough.
You don't see a way around what?
Well, around the racism. It's so insidious.
You don't think it'll go away?
Well, it's kind of shoved down our throats. And I know that historically there was a point in American history when, in the South, when the white slaves, because there were white slaves that came over from Ireland, and the Black slaves got together and tried to change their situation. And the whole point of the Ku Klux Klan was to put that racial division between Blacks and whites, mm-hmm. and to stop the coming together of people on a class level, on a more basic economic level.
Okay.
And just to keep it on that racial level. And it continues, always.
Thank you, Mary. Oops.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Do you want to comment? I wanted to get to the memorial, too, but...
Yeah, I would just say briefly, just a quick point of clarification. This is the historian in me coming out. We weren't talking about Irish slaves, but indentured servitude and indentured servants, and that's an important distinction. And there's a long history of how that plays out in colonial Virginia and the colonies very early on, and the shift away from that sort of indentured servitude to a kind of servitude that becomes racialized in racial slavery. But I think really, really quickly at the core of what she says, the caller had said, is this is an economic system. Sort of inequality and racism and white supremacy, how it has played out over the centuries in America, at its core, has been the exploitation of people of color and exploitation of labor. As we move into the 21st century, the reasons for the perpetuation of racism and white supremacy begins to change as labor demands begin to change. So it's a dynamic. The reason why it's been so difficult to deal with and why it's been so persistent is because it's so flexible. It's a dynamic system, and it's very powerful, and it's interwoven into the very fabric of American society.
So given what Mary just said and a lot of what other people have said today, it doesn't feel like it could ever go away. What's the significance, Professor Upton, of having the King Memorial on the National Mall now? What does it matter?
Well, I think that this can't be just a memorial in stone. It has to be a living legacy. And again, I take the liberty of saying that King probably didn't have that much of a problem, I think, with the role of Black power within the society. He understood the limitations of nonviolence, but he also understood the necessity of nonviolence. And I go back to what I said before. There had to be a role that someone had to play in this society, and those who were prepared for that role would be that you can't move forward in a society with violence begetting violence. As the way that I was raised, I mean, I was raised in a way in which someone insulted you, and you had to, or abused you, and you had to confront your oppressor, but you looked them in the eye, and you said to them, you know, I'm sorry. I really feel pity for you for your ignorance, and I forgive you for that. Now, all of us aren't called to do that. It's sort of a spiritual kind of grounding for that kind of orientation. And I think that's the way in a role. We play different roles in society, and I think that's the role and that's the calling of many members of our society, because King saw that we're all humans. We have a common destiny, but we've created, you know, nationality, identity boundaries that has separated us. How in the world can you have two societies and call it a democracy? You know, at least legally, up until 1964, the United States was not a democracy in any way or form or fashion. And this was dawned on everyone throughout the world as we were engaged in wars throughout the world to perpetuate democracy when you didn't practice it at home. And that's the legacy of King, and that's the way King should be remembered.
We have an email from Cheryl. She says, I will be attending the dedication in D.C. I was very young when Dr. King was assassinated, so I only knew what others told me. By attending the memorial dedication, I feel like I am part of the dream. I am so excited.
And she should be excited. I think Professor Upton really hit the nail on the head when he said that this memorial has to be a living legacy. And it's really it should be a starting point for so many. We know that the civil rights movement, African American history, really isn't taught very well, if at all, in many state curriculums. But this is a starting point for learning more about King, about his commitment to labor, his commitment to the poor, and his commitment to equality and voting rights for all people.
Thank you so much for joining us today, Hassan Kwame Jeffries.
Thank you very much for having me.
Hassan Kwame Jeffries, he's an associate professor in the history department at OSU. He also holds a joint appointment at the Kerwin Institute for the Study of Race and Ethnicity. He's the author of Bloody Lounge, Civil Rights and Black Power in Alabama's Black Belt. Also with us, James Upton. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Professor Upton, he is professor emeritus in the Department of African American and African Studies at OSU. He was awarded the OSU Alumni Award for Distinguished Teaching in 2003. Thanks, everybody, for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.